Welcome to A Dying Podcast. My name is Nils, and in today's episode, we have a guest online, so you never know what the audio quality will be like, but we hope it's going to be fine, and the guest is no other than Hansi Freinacht. How are you, Hansi?
I am very well, thank you.
Thank you for being here on this podcast. I've been looking forward to having this conversation with you, and I'm sure a lot of people listening will know who you are, but for anyone who's not informed about that, who is Hansi Freinacht?
I am a political philosopher. I have a background in sociology and criminology and police research, but life has led me onto a quite other path, a kind of sense of malady, pervading sense of loss or dissatisfaction with the existence of everyday life. And it kind of nags at the rims of your mind, at the core of your being. You feel there is another greater world of potential that is not being manifested in my own life and in the life of so many other people. And that potential is in turn what I believe is the key, the golden key, I would say, to resolving the greatest crises and existential threats of our day and age and the emergence of a global civilization. And this having followed me around for many years, I looked for philosophical answers, I looked for spiritual answers, for psychological answers, and indeed for political answers to the dilemmas of our time. And might there be a connection between the existential angst and the alienation experienced by highly individualized and highly sensitive and highly developed people in our day and age, and the great structures, the great structural challenges that face us? And the umbrella term that I have come to dedicate my life to, which is not easily caught in an elevator pitch, I say, let's always take the stairs, is metamodernism. And I've specialized then as a writer and thinker and a proponent of metamodernism in culture, in philosophy, in politics, and in life in general. Metamodernism, I believe, is a potential future stage of modern society, one which consciously and deliberately redefines modern culture, which takes culture into its hands and through intelligently weaved mechanisms and new political institutions designs culture and updates culture and updates norms and psychological frameworks and everyday interactions and the nature of everyday life so as to better fit with the highly complex society that we live in today. And that's my mission, and that in a way is who I am.
Amazing. So if we take this moment to take the stairs then and skip the elevator and go deeper into metamodernism, and how do you see this updating from where we are today, or where are we today to begin with, and what's this update that you foresee happening?
So there has been much debate among scholars of how to define our day and age, and not just among scholars, among the general public as well. Some people believe that we live in a modern society, and that's a meaningful term. Other people believe that we just live in an industrial age with the globalization, and that modernity itself is too broad a concept. Some people believe that we live in a postmodern age, that modern society has already ended, and that new dynamics and cultural dynamics have come to the fore and emerged as the dominant logic of our time, and that the game rules of the game have fundamentally changed. Metamodernists believe something in between, and it's a bit of a third position. So metamodernists do believe that there is a meaningful progression from modern, or pre-modern for that matter, to modern society, to postmodern critique of modern society, to a metamodern new stage of society. So I believe that we live today in the late modern age, that we are at the end of a large modern system, of a world system in the death throes of modernity. And I believe then that the postmodern critique, all the left intellectuals, all the environmentalism, all the critique of structures, all the critique of capitalism, all the critique of gender power structures, of ethnicity power structures, of the global north-south axis, all of these things that we think of within the postmodern framework, I believe these are not a stable stage around which society can materialize and crystallize. So rather than, I think that we have to go from the deteriorating late modern stage with amassing difficulties and amassing pathologies, meaning sicknesses of an aging system, of an aging world system, we have to take a leap, a great leap, to a metamodern stage of interaction, of economy, of politics. And that's where we are right now. We have to assess the current modern system and see that for all its glory, for all its power, for all the beauty of ideas like democracy, science, individualism, humanism, these ideas no longer hold up as a narrative that can and will create a thriving global civilization, one that is able to survive. Rather, if we continue with business as usual, according to the social and economic logic of the modern system, things will be cracking up more and more, and there will be increasing problems, which is what we're seeing in the world today. Even though there are no huge catastrophes like the Second World War going on, we do have climate change, we do have a number of technological existential risks, we do have a complete lack of credible, feasible leadership on the global stage, and we have no global structures of governance to steer this age in the right direction. Furthermore, we have an incorrect, or rather an out of pace socialization and education of the citizens of society, so that people grow into having modern mindsets, whereas we are already leaving the modern world, the modern stage. And this creates a situation where the populations and where our everyday understandings of the world are simply not properly updated. They are not in tune with the society we actually live in, with the culture we live in, with the economic realities of globalization, with the technological disruption, with our huge impact on the ecological systems around us. And this creates a great impetus, a moral impetus, I would say, for the metamodernists to organize and to create ideas about how to change and shift the socialization of populations so that people feel supported and seen and heard, and that they grow, that we grow, and that we grow together as human beings, that our personalities develop in other and more subtle ways, so that we may together create a sustainable, thriving global civilization. This, I believe, has to begin from certain points in the world system, from the more progressive, more developed parts of the world system, such as, for instance, the Scandinavian countries, which is why I have titled the second book Nordic Ideology. It's nothing to do with actually the Nordics or an essence within Scandinavia, but it has to do with this kind of overall development of the population, of its you could say level of consciousness and its culture and the institutions of society.
So, I mean, the sort of ongoing systemic failure seems pretty obvious, I would say, to most people. And as you describe it, we will be moving into a metamodernistic society. And obviously that transition will most likely not be very smooth. And also you mentioned the Scandinavian countries as one of the areas in the world where, you know, this could happen sooner rather than later. So what other places like that do you see, and what are concrete examples of this shift happening? What will a metamodern society look like, would you say?
Yeah, so on a basic level, you can see in societies that are far progressed in modernity and are, have been highly stable over a long period of time, so that people have had the time and opportunity and safety to develop their personalities, relations, and ways of life and views of the world, such as the Scandinavian countries. You might also mention Holland, and of course, not just Scandinavia, the Nordics, Finland, is perhaps the prime example these days. And within the progressive parts of the US culture, within the progressive parts of Canadian culture, in New Zealand, I suppose, in Australia to a certain extent, you have the prerequisites to enough people who see the need for something new in the political and social realm, and in the economic realm for that matter. And looking then at the Scandinavian countries specifically, these are renowned for their extensive welfare systems. This shouldn't be glamorized. There are plenty cracks in the wall in Scandinavian welfare systems, and it's usually a bit exaggerated how well these welfare systems function. But just the very fact that you have a highly competitive capitalist economy combined with a highly functional, not very corrupt bureaucracy, combined with a highly functional democracy, combined with a lively civil society, and a welfare system of one kind or another, in this case, state-sponsored, that supports people in their basic needs. So very few people have to worry about starving, very few people have to worry about at least shorter periods of unemployment, very few people have to worry about healthcare issues. Of course, everybody worries about their health still. So with these things out of the way, these countries have the opportunity to take the next step in the development of welfare. And that's what I call the listening society. A society which creates a higher form of welfare that looks to existential health, that looks to psychological health, and looks to the nature and quality of socialization through life's phases. And this would entail much greater therapeutic training for all citizens. It would entail perhaps science-driven teaching of meditative and contemplative practice. It might entail greater focus on maintaining a healthy body and mind. It might entail a greater focus on nurturing and cultivating emotional intelligence in the population, social intelligence, the ability to take perspectives, perspective taking, and it may entail collective intelligence, meaning practice in being an intelligent group or team. So different societies can have different levels of collective intelligence. And the Nordic countries today have relatively high collective intelligence, it might be argued. They are relatively capable as societies of together tackling problems. Right now, they are losing grip, however, of a too difficult situation with the state and the population still working within the modern system and the ideas of the nation state in a globalized internet economy with global challenges. So for this reason, these countries, I believe, can and should create political movements which embrace metamodern ideas and work across different political parties, transpartially, as I call it, to insert the metamodern DNA into many different settings so that metamodern ideas can and will saturate the entire political scale, the entire bureaucracy, the entire educational system. And that's the great challenge of metamodern activists today. So it's a very long-term, theory-driven, science-driven, patience-demanding, painstaking kind of work, a kind of non-linear revolutionary act to support metamodern emergence. And this kind of metamodern political movement must be process-oriented, i.e., it must focus not on the specifics of any one of these issues, but rather it must create the generative conditions, meaning the settings, the social settings and rules of interaction and game and norms, which will create a better debate climate, a better dialogue climate, a more intelligent conversation in society about society itself across all political positions. And if you look then at these very same countries, if you look at Sweden and Denmark, for instance, there is indeed a growing unrest in the population vis-a-vis the political discourse. People feel that the political discourse is empty, is devoid of meaning, and is often reduced to a thuggish football game, and that there is no real deliberation, no real understanding going on across the political parties. And this is a sign that metamodernism is slowly brewing in these populations, because that in itself is the entry point to a metamodern view of the world, which is metamodern philosophy is a synthesizing philosophy. It attempts to bridge apparently opposing positions in non-arbitrary ways. It always looks for the understanding that will make you partially right and me partially right, even if we disagree, and let us reach a new and higher synthesis, even though we don't agree, and without it landing in a lowest common denominator or a lowest or a weak consensus or a weak compromise. So we have to create these structures for deliberation, for a deepening of democracy. And in these very countries, you see an increasing demand for this. And whenever I speak about these ideas in and around these countries, people seem to light up. There is a demand, a wish for this, for a deeper democratic movement, for a process-oriented kind of meta-political party, one that specializes in increasing the quality of politics, increasing the quality of governance itself.
So when you see this demand increasing, and I very much see it too, do you also see, beyond its sort of brewing on the surface, do you see initiatives? Do you see examples of this metamodern activism happening in these countries or in other countries?
Yes. So in the second book that I published, it's called Nordic Ideology. I offer a vision of six new forms of politics. And to get the full metamodern picture, I believe all of these six new forms must be consciously held at the same time, and they must balance one another. But what I can see around myself in these countries particularly, but also around the world, is that people get a handle or grasp one or two of them. One of two are these six dimensions. So some people understand that we need a deepening democracy. So there are many initiatives in this direction. Some people understand that we must base our policies much more on science and empirical understanding and the best available evidence. So there are also there's also a growing number of evidence-based political movements and skepticism. There is also there are also spiritual parties who see the value of existential development, of existential health, and the relationship of the self to the world and to one another. So these see the potential of existential politics. And on it goes. You see these simmering micro movements, and they they appear with increasing rapidity. The metamodern challenge is to draw upon the experiences of these many simmering micro movements across these six dimensions and link them up and get the best people from each of them to see the value of the others and to link them up into an ecosystem of metamodern expertise, because each of these new forms of politics will require expertise. And yes, there are even quite concrete examples of when the party in Denmark, the Alternative, which I was initially a supporter of, but now I believe they've somehow lost their impetus and their grasp of more metamodern ideas and fall back into, I would say, a more postmodern environmentalism. This Danish party was called the Alternative, and in their platform there was deliberately and explicitly stated that this was a process-oriented party which worked across the political spectrum to improve the quality of discourse. And they proposed a number of norms of how to relate to the political debate and to other political parties. And that in itself is a metamodern move. And you can see then that even though the early metamodern movements are failing, even though they're not being successful at this time, the attractors are pulling in this direction, meaning the things that are likely to happen in the long run, because more and more people wake up to this kind of shared new understanding of the world, and then they link up with other people, and then there's a frustration with the society that we have. And then more and more people have valuable experiences from all of these experiments. So yes, there is definitely something brewing and definitely something going on, but patience, patience, patience. We won't have a flood of spiritual enlightenment or anything else around the corner. It's going to grow painstakingly, and we have to learn by doing, and we have to learn through our mistakes. And also, of course, as the world system continues to slowly fall apart, this is also a wake-up call to more and more people.
Do you expect us to reach a tipping point? I understand it's probably impossible to sort of give a forecast on when this shift will go into full force. But what is your current forecast? Even though I know it's impossible,
I do have a current forecast. Of course, lightly held, I suppose you could say, ironically held. But there is a sincerity to that irony. I both believe this, and I don't. The tipping point is around 20 years ahead, and then the tipping point is only in these more progressive parts of the world. Meaning that the current young generation, Generation Z, the ones younger than the millennials, are going to first try to go for a more neoconservative direction. And this is also what the polls are showing with heroes such as Jordan Peterson, etc., which do some good work. And a lot of metamodern young people I come across have found their way to metamodernism through this kind of thinking. There is a sense that in many people today that, wait a minute, we have been excessively politically correct. We have been subtly oppressed by postmodern norms, and these identity politics aren't going anywhere, and they end up in blame games. And people want to go back to basics. So a bit of reinvented nationalism shows up, a bit of common sense conservatism comes back on the map, a bit of good old individualism and do your own thing before you try to change the world seems to take a strong hold. And I believe, and also, of course, populism of different kinds, nationalist populism, anti-immigration populism, and all of these lowest common denominator, simple explanation movements. And I think people will have to try these things out first. They are less complex, easier to grasp, more intuitive. And it's been such a long time since fascism and today's and the Second World War. So today's young people are less allergic to going to the a bit farther to the right. So first of all, I think we're going to see a reactionary wave, and it's going to last for a while, and then its solutions are going to have to be tried out, try to combat the powers of globalization and the excesses of postmodern ideas. A revolt of the popular, a revolt of the common man and woman, vis-a-vis the intellectuals and the all the progressive norms they have spread through different media and universities and so forth. But I don't think that leads us anywhere. I don't think it. What I don't hear in those circles is a real solution to the real global problems of the aging modern world system. Modern world system has, of course, three major problems which are inherent to modernity, and these are that it has lacking sustainability, will crash sooner or later, that it has excess inequality. Even if a capitalist system can, across the globe, can make a lot of people a lot richer, it still creates huge pockets of deprivation and inequality. And the third one, and the most subtle one, and the most one most sensed by people in rich countries, is alienation. That modern life often doesn't feel that meaningful. It often feels subtly dissatisfying on a spiritual or existential or deep psychological level, and on a deeply personal level. And I don't see the solution to these problems. Only a band-aid on the wounds in these neo-reactionary, neo-nationalist movements. So after humanity has tried this stuff out, and those ideas are no longer edgy and cool, the kids who grow up with all that in the background, and also look back at postmodernism and don't find reliable answers there, will be open enough to try to really tackle metamodern ideas, and the days of metamodernism will be in the future, because they analyze the life conditions of only small parts of the population today. But as life becomes more late modern and the metamodern potentials become more apparent, and the metamodern logic of life becomes more apparent in the lives of young people who have grown up in this kind of chaotic society, then more will be receptive to metamodernism. So I believe that the metamodern generation is being born, actually starting perhaps from 2020. And when they turn 20, from there on, we will be able to create real metamodern solutions across society. So we're looking at a 20-year horizon for metamodernism to start seriously taking over political leadership within core nodes of the world system, certain big cities, certain minor states, and so on. And from there on, these can start affecting the global order.
Cool. And then obviously, to me at least, that in itself is a journey, because it won't go from nothing and then all of a sudden political leadership starts implementing these ideas. So who do you see as sort of the key organizations? Yeah, exactly. Like who will be pushing that change to finally then reach political leadership? Hmm.
So I'm all these simmering micro movements, and they always start off with an inspired idea and a bunch of people getting together, and then they make a bunch of hard life experiences. So, and it's in that big game of life and in those disappointments that people are nevertheless preparing the ground and making the experiments that will sooner or later be able to hook up with one another and resonate with one another and create metamodern forms of governance and metamodern movements and metamodern networks and so forth, metamodern companies and organizations and all of that, and metamodern parties, I suppose, which would be hopefully transnationally based. Perhaps the EU might be a good arena. And around yourself and I, there are networks of people who are highly interesting in this regard. I would call them the triple H population, meaning the hackers, the hipsters, and the hippies. And each of these represent some element of metamodern culture. Hackers, of course, understand internet society better than anyone, and they have informational capital, and they can create new tools which create new architectures or new infrastructures of information which organize society in new ways, and which organize networks and socialize minds in new ways and steer deliberation and democracy in a better direction. But not only, of course, the hackers, you have the hipsters, which are good at the arts and good at analyzing culture, good at symbols, good at critique, and generally have a finger on the pulse of global culture, and who can give aesthetic form and have the cultural flavor or taste of a metamodern movement, which can attract minds and inspire people. And then you have the hippies, meaning people who are deep into self-expression, self-exploration, inner worlds, therapy, self-development, spirituality, contemplation, all of these practices which work with the self, which work with inner issues, which are entirely necessary for us to function in this more and more challenging environment. I mean, in material sense, many of us live in greater and greater abundance. But in an existential and social and spiritual sense, many of us live in greater and greater confusion. And for this reason, we have to expend hours and days and months of our lives to work on ourselves, to work on our inner traumas and heal them, to redefine our relationships, to achieve higher subjective states in everyday life, that we walk around a little bit more awakened, a little bit more alert, a little bit happier, a little bit more present, and that we can learn from peak experiences, which revamp our view of ourselves, the universe, and our place in it. So these three groups are not separate entities, but they overlap in an increasing manner. For instance, around the Burning Man Festival culture, for instance, around the update of Burning Man Festival culture, which you are trying to start, this World of Wisdom initiative. And these movements or these arenas resonate on a profound level with what I call metamodernism. It's unimportant whether or not we use that term. It's just an umbrella term to catch this shared sense, this shared new social logic. And for this reason, when metamodernists do get together, people who resonate around these frequencies, I'm not saying that in a woo way, just resonate with one another and feel a sense of recognition when they meet each other, it's often very easy to become good friends really fast. And from there on, you can build relationships where friendship is the basis, but from the friendship grows perhaps professional relationships, and if you deepen it further, political relationships, civic relationships, relationships that have to do with how you want to change society. So these, I suppose, are the heroes of our story, the Triple H population. Within the Triple H population, you might zoom in on a smaller group of people who embody all three of these qualities and have an explicit metamodern theory in their backpack, and who can analyze the world with a metamodern lens, and who also have the luxury in their lives to not be bogged down by too much other responsibilities, who can commit their lives to a metamodern shift in society and think strategically and long-term about it. And these we call the metamodern aristocracy, not because they are aristocrats in the old sense, but simply because they are people who have the luxury to live metamodern lives.
Fascinating. And just hearing you speak awakens a lot of thoughts in me and a lot of recognition. And I have three things that are sort of circling in my head right now that two of them are also a clear shift in society. One is the growth of the transformation economy, where consumerism is shifting towards actually consuming personal transformation to a higher degree. Mm-hmm. And then we have the entire shift into decentralization and the growth of blockchain, which is more sort of in the hacker side of things. And then myself personally, I've been very interested in the work of Ken Wilber and integral theories of just about anything. So I understand these are three fairly separate things, but if I just like put them on the table, and you can pick anyone you like, how do these things fit into this shift that we're seeing?
Oh, they all fit very neatly. None of them can fundamentally transform the structures of modern society by themselves. You would require to have state administrations which actively and deliberately support them. And that's the goal. But yes, each of these three movements or transformations towards decentralization, towards inner transformation, have to do with the shifting dynamics of the world economy. So looking then at how we organize the economy today, we have a relatively primitive way of calculating utility. We are still stuck with the models of 19th century economics, even though everybody challenges those models, but they are the ones that we fall back to as a lowest common denominator. And for this reason, it appears as though investing on a political level, investing millions or billions or dollars into, let's say, inner work and meditation would look like a horrible waste to most people. Because, hey, you're not producing anything, you're not being a good consumer, you're not making the wheels turn, and so forth. You are just getting people to sit there and look inwards and work with things that are not tangible and produce no visible results. But if you look at it from a lens of the economy of happiness, meaning how do you optimize with every piece of resource, how do you optimize attention and time so that it increases human happiness, sustainable and authentic human happiness, reduces human and animal suffering, of course, and does so in a way that has the lowest possible ecological footprint, then we're in a completely different ballgame in terms of the calculations we would make for our economy. And things that today would look not at all like a profitable investment might, with that kind of lens, look very reasonable. So one of the major shifts that we have to make is to create a political discourse and institutions which support these post-modern state structures, including structures which actually challenge and tear at the state structures such as the currencies. We are going to enter an age which is driven more completely and fully by the internet. And the internet has really taken over everybody's lives and snuck up on us. And now we are all spending 7 hours per day or whatnot by screens. And we are always linked by social media and email and news feeds and all of these things. And of course, the dynamics of the world market are going to change and are already changing. And in that new dynamic, then production, and with the high technology that we have today, with the self-running production plants and so forth, and increasing amount of AI work, artificial intelligence, then, and of course, drones and everything else that's coming up, and self-driving cars, we are going to have to focus a lot less on what a person is going to produce Because that's just one part of the equation, and a relatively small part of the equation. It used to be the main thing. The main problem of life used to be we don't have enough and we need to produce more. So the question every kid was asked, what are you going to do? What are you going to produce? In this new metamodern equilibrium state, equilibrium stage, we will have to create a new kind of citizenship and a new kind of identity for the citizen. So we are going to identify both as producers and consumers, including prosumers, meaning that we offer value through our consumption. And we are going to identify as citizens and what we do in civic life. And we are going to identify in terms of personal relationships to a higher degree and who we are as a human being. And when you ask somebody, who are you? What do you do? We might answer from any of those four categories, putting professional work and production and distribution of goods back in its proper place. It's just one part of the larger equation. If we don't develop consumption to be more ethical and more optimized according to an economy of happiness, if we don't optimize our civic relationships, meaning our relationships to society at large and our political will in society, and if we don't optimize our personal relationships, then we can produce all the goods in the world and the whole thing will still come crashing down on us. So we have to create, we have to go from citizen modern, which identifies as a producer or distributor of goods and services, to a citizen metamodern, citizen MM, which identifies with all of these four categories and might even not identify with one or two of them, including the production. So these larger, and the citizen MM in turn requires a higher personal development, requires higher self-reflection, hence an investment in inner transformation. And it requires higher autonomy on the market and autonomy vis-a-vis the systems around us. And that requires decentralization of many different kinds. And what was the third one you mentioned?
The third example from transformation economy, blockchain, and then the integral theories of Ken Wilber.
Oh, yes. And then in order to create such a... to create such a new citizenship, it is important that people grow in their in our worldviews, to adopt more holistic views, that we see ourselves more as part of nature, more as part of culture and society, that we see our own developmental journey and our own hero's journey more clearly. And this requires these kind of meta theories that Ken Wilber and integral theory exemplify. Then there are, of course, a few flaws of that theory, which are criticized in my books. But I believe that there is a deep resonance between those theories, and I have a background in them as well, and this new kind of citizenship that must emerge. So yes, all of these factors are branches of a metamodern emergence of a new layer of society. And this layer is going to be thin to begin with, and thin and full of cracks and full of faults.
So a question I have then, if you look at what drives individuals in this society, obviously this is very different depending on where you live and what part of society you've been born into. But in society where I've been growing up in Sweden, it's a society built around success and individual success. So we know what that looks like today, but how does individual success look in a metamodern society?
So I would supplant the ideal of success, which is highly understandable that it emerges. Nobody actually thought about it and forced everybody to that conclusion. It's just that we see the success of others and we measure one another, and we can't help but subscribe to the success criteria of modern life. But if we can take the hands of one another and together shift to other norms and other expectations upon ourselves and one another, then I would propose two such criteria. One would be healing, meaning that everybody is a highly vulnerable person, and that needs to be recognized and not stigmatized. And everybody who has grown up has known adversities and has had contradictions in their lives and are imperfect in so many ways and are hurt in subtle layers of the soul, and these things stick in our bodies as well. So there would be a shared ideal of healing that everybody, no matter how powerful or successful in life, needs to heal. Everybody needs some extra self-awareness, some new layer of insight. We're never done. We're always filling in the cracks because life hurts. And if life is to be beautiful, we have to make sure that we're not driven by that hurt in our relationships and our production. We have to make sure that we're not driven by fear or a sense of lack, but that we're driven by love and a sense of abundance. And that requires an enthusiasm and creativity. And for that to happen, we must feel whole as human beings. And everybody, I suppose, has had some periods in their lives where we felt a bit more whole, and we noticed the difference, how we are more open to new ideas, how we take on bigger projects, how we have greater enthusiasm, how we are kinder to the people around us. And everybody has had periods in our lives where we are driven by economic fears, by our old traumas, and all of these things. And it should be a shared explicit goal of our culture to heal these wounds and to address these traumas. And there should be an openness towards this process. The second ideal is growth. The second ideal is growth because there appear to be certain directions in developmental psychology, certain directions in which the human mind and soul can grow. There is a difference between different perspectives, that some are more complex and more worked through, and others are more simple and black and white. Some are more nuanced. Some people have a greater emotional intelligence after having grown through a crisis, for instance, and higher perspective taking, greater humility vis-a-vis the life experiences and perspectives of others. And there is a directionality there that we can, as human beings, grow into higher stages of adult development. And the later stages of adult development link up very elegantly with metamodern philosophy, I would argue, and with a metamodern view of life. You start to viewing yourself as part of a greater process. You start viewing yourself as a transformational project or object. Value inner dimensions of life more. You value relationships and emotions more. You value larger goals for larger for society and higher ideals for society more. And you widen your circles of solidarity from including perhaps only family and friends to including everybody you meet on the street to including just any human being on the planet to including animals, to including the ecosystems and the biosphere, and the future generations. And it becomes more and more difficult the higher up you climb in these circles of solidarity. But the circles of solidarity are not mere ideas. It doesn't help to just tell myself that, oh, I care about everybody always, forever. These things have to be embodied. They have to be part of who we are as human beings. And they have to be part of what we authentically feel and what authentically rewards us when we think about it and act upon it. And that requires inner growth. And of course, that's the direction we should take. So healing and growth would supplant success in a metamodern society as the ideals of what it is to be an adult human being, which actually are the same ideals as we have for childhood today. Doesn't mean that we should treat everybody as a child, meaning that they don't have autonomy over their own life. But it means that we should treat everybody as somebody who is still being born, somebody who can still be reborn, and somebody who is plastic and has great plasticity in their brain, who is somebody who can achieve new worldviews, which will be more beneficial for themselves and others. But those worldviews shouldn't be given, though. They have to grow through the emergent property, through generative conditions. That if you create the best possible conditions for people to find their own highest possible truths, then people will find higher truths than they do today and live by them.
What speaks to me there, how you're describing this focus on healing and growth as the measures of success for an individual, and in that sense, approaching the individual as a person, as a being that will is sort of never done in a way. Yeah. It's this continuous growth and continuous healing. It really just mimics evolution, right? Yeah. Perfectly. It just feels like a much more natural way to look at a living creature than older and even current societal systems. So we're coming up on the hour, and just before we end this very interesting and fascinating conversation. So you're saying that you're expecting this shift to come into full force maybe 20 years from now. At the same time, we have, you know, systems failing all around us, and that might very well go faster than these 20 years. So at least I sense that we are in a desperate need of a new system to build the foundations of society upon. What can one do if this resonates to sort of propel this change? It's naturally evolving and happening anyway, and it definitely looks that way. But if you want to be a metamodern activist, so to speak, what can one do?
Yeah, so among the metamodern activists, I guess you can look at three categories. These were formulated by Bardon Söderqvist, but they work relatively well here. So there are the networkers, the philosophers, and the entrepreneurs, basically. And the networkers gather the metamodernists together and link them together in meaningful and useful ways. So you can grow your metamodern network. You can see which people do I resonate with, which people would resonate with one another, and where can there be interesting emergences? Where can something happen? Where can something occur? And you kind of get the greater network you have, the more perspectives you can take, and the better you can facilitate these networks, the more magic you can work in this field. And this is emergence. So think of it as a bubble chamber, one bubble here, another bubble there. And one out of these 1 million bubbles is going to grow a lot larger and have a larger impact. And the networker is entirely crucial there. The second category would be the entrepreneur, which tries to create metamodern organizations here and now. You can make a metamodern business plan, for instance, by putting into practice mechanisms of growth and healing in work life, and you can formulate the goals of the company according to one of the long-term attractors that would transform the economy in an equitable or sustainable direction. And these kinds of businesses can compete on the global market because by attracting highly complex thinkers and by being experts on managing complexity, which is, after all, the greatest challenge of our day and age, and creating meaningful narratives around these managements of complexity and creating informational frameworks around them, or informational frameworks geared to get out of different prisoner dilemmas and so forth, and create better organizations and create better governance structures and all of these things. Because these things are in demand, the most metamodern, in quotation marks, entrepreneurs and innovators are also likely to, in the long run, compete on the market very well, and they will be able to attract highly intelligent, highly metamodern innovators, because they will support them and they will offer them lifestyles which cannot be, and meaningful projects which cannot be bought for money. So for this reason, you can actually pay less for higher competency to do more complex tasks, and like that, work your way towards the centers of the world economy. And that's a very, very, very important part of the metamodern activism in the business world. And this third part is the philosophers, which people such as myself, who analyze society and analyze different parts of the political realm, or understand complexity, understand the stages of developmental growth, and also, of course, challenge those theories. Developmental theories aren't necessarily the best ones. And who offer new ideas and narratives which are useful to people working in the in all of the other projects. And for instance, there is today a small political party in Sweden based entirely around metamodern ideas. And that's possible, I believe, to a certain extent, because there have been philosophers such as myself who have formulated these ideas, written them down, so that enough people can share the same idea world and then resonate around them, and then make something come into being. So networkers, entrepreneurs, and philosophers are, I suppose, doers of two kinds and thinkers of one kind. And of course, these three intermingle. The best crystallization, though, isn't necessarily to put all the philosophers with all the other philosophers and all the entrepreneurs with all the other entrepreneurs and so forth. Rather, they should make up little teams or cells of metamodern activism. One networker connected to perhaps two other philosophers and two other entrepreneurs, and then each entrepreneur can have two philosopher friends and two networker friends. And like that, we can support each other. If we just put all the philosophers in one heap, they will argue over the details and never get anything done. If we put all the entrepreneurs, they will start competing for the same investments and capital and so forth. So you have to put a bit of a buffer between the entrepreneurs, a buffer of philosophers and networkers and so forth. And the networkers, of course, all work to be the central node. So they should also be interspersed with people of the other kinds.
Fantastic. This has been fascinating, and a very good summary, of course, of metamodernism. So if anyone listening is interested to learn more, where can we find your books and your work?
So The Listening Society and Nordic Ideology are available on Amazon, both as Kindle and as print. And I am working on a third book. It's called The Six Hidden Patterns of World History. And there is also metamoderna.org. And there are, of course, many networks and Facebook groups on metamodernism. I'm not an expert on cultural metamodernism, but if you're more into the arts and architecture and popular culture and seeing how metamodern culture is being analyzed and understood these days, you can find plenty of people working with that, often following the Dutch school of metamodernism. I represent the Nordic school, I suppose you could say, which is more political.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Hansi Freinach, for being part of this podcast. And for anyone listening, as always, reach out with questions, thoughts, emotions, ideas, what have you. And you will hear me again, most likely next week. Thank you very much.